All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Tuckians? What the fuckinistas? What's happening? Mark Maron here. This is my podcast, WTF. Oh man, is it going to be a lispy day? What's wrong with my mouth day? Happens sometimes. How's it going? I'm sorry. Did I make it about me for a second more than I usually do? Nice to be here. Nice to talk to you. Lots happened since I've last spoken to you. What day is today? Thursday? It's Thursday. So I went to the Emmys on Monday. I haven't talked to you since Monday. And that afternoon, I went to the Emmy Awards for the first time in my life. For the first time in my life, I went to the Emmys and I was on a nominated show for Best Comedy, GLOW. And we lost. But hey, even though we lost, aren't we all just losers? Is that the right? That's not it, isn't it? Even though we didn't win, aren't we all winners anyways? I like it my way. Hey, even though we lost, aren't we all losers? I think that's equally as inspiring. Hey, sure, we lost, but we're all losers. Ultimately, most of the time that turns out to be true. I would say proportionately to, hey, we didn't win, but we're all winners. That is really non-objective stuff. So, you know, maybe this is too negative. I'll tell you about the Emmys. I'll talk to you about Slash, who is my guest today on the podcast. The Slash from Guns N' Roses and from Slash's Snake Pit and from Velvet Revolver and from Slash featuring Miles Kennedy and the conspirators. But he's Slash, man. It's fucking Slash. And it's interesting because as much as I love Guns N' Roses and some of Slash's solo work, I don't know that I identified him as thoroughly as I did the other night. After I talked to him, I went to the Whiskey to see Slash and Miles Kennedy and the conspirators. Now, do I want to tell you about this? Let's ease into this. It was revelatory. I'll tell you how revelatory seeing Slash and Miles Kennedy and the conspirators at the Whiskey, which seats like 12 people. I'll tell you how revelatory it was. I stayed for the entire fucking show. I didn't even stay for the whole Emmys. Yeah, that's right. I mean, those of you who have watched my special Too Real, available on Netflix now, and you know my bit about the Stones concert, I don't stay for shit because the idea of waiting for my car or getting to my car or waiting to get out of a situation in my car will almost preclude me, is that the word, from staying till the end of anything, especially when you know it's going to end, especially if it's another song or especially if you've already lost everything you stood to lose. Because, hey, we're all losers. I told you, I guess, about a week ago that LaFonda had a growth on her mouth, and me and Sarah the painter kind of put our minds together. I had the box already. I put a towel in the box. I had it open for seizing that moment of getting that little fist of feline fury into the box to take her to the vet. And, you know, Sarah said, I don't think you should take her. I'm like, oh, well, it's a little like nodule there. It's a little thing on her lip. But she had gotten zits there before. And then I looked up cat zits and mouth cat zits and then mouth cancer. She decided that maybe you should just wait it out because she's had stuff there before. Cats get zits on their face. So I waited it out and it looks like it's getting better. So as it stands now, Monkey and LaFonda, 14 plus years old, holding strong, lean, energetic. Buster, the kitten, couple years old almost, out of his fucking mind. It's like this house that I'm living in now, there's two floors, it's old, it's wooden, there's not a lot of rugs, and it feels like a fucking rodeo in the morning because he's figured out this route for himself from the end of the hall upstairs, and he runs all the way down the hall, down the stairs, where he jumps about three or four stairs and plunks down onto the floor, runs into the living room, does some business in there, flips around, comes running back up the stairs. This can go on at 2 a.m, 3 a.m, 4 a.m, active little fuck, not a lot of love for him in those moments, but doing well and learning to take affection. He's resistant and he's peculiar and he's awkward when you pet him. He's one of the only cats I know that really likes to be pet like a dog, scratched on the back, on the stomach, and then you gotta kind of really get him to not squirm out of it. In other words, emotionally, he's exactly like me. So I wanted to read this now that we're in cat zone. I wanted to read this because there's not so much hopeful, happy stories in the world. And this one, you know, I'm not going to spoil it. All right. Because we're all losers and I'm not going to spoil it. But I want to read it to you now that we're in the cat zone. Subject line: Kipling lives. My boyfriend Adam is a massive fan of this podcast. I'd never heard of Marin before I met him and am now a convert. Recently, his Siamese, Kipling, went missing on a canoe trip. I have to interject here. Who the fuck takes their cat on a canoe trip? I won't even let my cat outside. All right, I know there are special animals. Mine are special in their own way. Apparently, Kipling can be on a canoe. So, back to the story. After the canoe capsized, we tipped. Adam grabbed the cat, and then the canoe hit Adam, and Kipling went under, and we didn't see him again. Ugh, terrible feeling. We searched for hours. This cat was always going hiking, camping, and swimming with us. We went back the next day trying to find his body or signs of him and didn't find anything. That's the worst, not knowing. We even got an amateur diver to help us search underwater for his remains. Where'd you find that guy? Still, no Kip. We took to social media and shared his story with everyone. There were hundreds of shares and likes and comments, and we even had coworkers, we work for an animal hospital, that took out search dogs to track him. We had no idea if he made it out of the river at this point. Adam was devastated. This cat was a spot of emotional stability for him. Sorry, Adam. I know the feeling, buddy. After 20 days, we got a call. Someone found him in a hayfield 10 miles away from where we lost him. He was 10 miles closer to home, actually. Somehow, this cat survived a rapid river and trekked 10 miles to find some humans to take him home. God damn it, that's a good story. Anyway, we like to be super clever and yell, "Kipling lives!" and thought this story may be enjoyed by our favorite cat-enthused comedian. Thanks for the laughs, Jeffy and Adam. You're welcome. What a fucking great story. Cats, canoes, started out, I was judging you guys. I was judging you. Why are you bringing the cat out? What are you doing with the cat out in those situations? But he's that kind of cat, and fuck, you got him back. You know, it just doesn't happen that often. Congratulations. I'm happy for you. I'm happy for cat lovers everywhere right now. You hear the story about the cat that disappears for 10 years and comes back. I don't know. I always doubt those ones. But this one sounds legit. And congratulations. You're a winner that day. Okay, so the Emmys. Let's go through it. I went through it. Why shouldn't I drag you through it? So me, Sarah the Painter, go to the Emmys. We get there. We got a car at like 1:30 to get there at 2:30 so I could go walk the photo line. And she posed in a couple pictures with me, which we don't usually do. But it kind of paid off because we got one of the cutest couples picture in People magazine. That's exciting. Got dressed up. She was dressed up. And then we got through the press line because we got there before almost anybody. And we were in an entirely empty Emmys theater watching them do final touches on the set and getting cameras straightened out and the ushers getting their focus on for what was going to be a giant show business clusterfuck at, you know, an hour away. And then people started coming in and they started trickling in. And I was sitting next to all the children. I was sitting in front of all the children from Stranger Things and two rows behind all the cats from Silicon Valley. All of us losers. I don't know. I don't really know. I think we all won something. But so it all started filling in, and it was exciting to see. I like, as you know, I enjoy running into celebrities. I like seeing people I've had on the show so I can say hi. I did see David Harbour. I went out of my way to go engage with David Harbour, who also lost So after he lost, I made a point to go up to him and give him a hug and say, congratulations. He laughed, and then he just lit me up, man. Like, David Harbour is like a human energy generating system. He's like a battery, man. You just, you lock in, you stay open. Very exciting, because I was starting to fade a little bit. We only brought a bag of almonds, which we had to spread out. I walked around a bit on a break, ran into John Oliver. We had a laugh about how hopeless everything is and how it's very hard providing hope because there isn't any, but it's kind of our job to be as straightforward as possible with our hopelessness and somehow make it painfully funny. And he won a goddamn Emmy for it. Congratulations, John. There are a few people in this business who I adore and I think are great. He's one of them. I was happy for him. So yeah, so I saw John Oliver. I talked to him a bit. And then, you know, I said hi to people. Yeah, here and there. It was exciting. You know, the kids from Stranger Things reminded me what it was like to be a kid for a second. Not quite a kid at the Emmys, but, you know, that age. Michael and Colin did a great job. I think there was something odd about the pacing. Everything seemed to happen too fast, yet it was still long. I don't know how that happened, but the show itself was like they would, you know, quickly announce and show pictures of the nominees. Then just someone would walk out, announce the winner. They would run up. They had like a second and they'd run off. And even when they went up to get it, they didn't sort of readdress what the show was. I don't know how it looked at home, but it seemed like I noticed they were doing something to quicken the pace of the show, but somehow it sucked some of the humanity of it. But nonetheless, I thought the people that did the jobs well. I got a couple of laughs. And I stayed right up until after we lost. I somehow, Sarah and I left to get to go to the restroom. The one time we left in the 9-hour thing to go to the restroom was the segment where Mulaney won and the guy proposed. The one segment where something actually happened with an amazing dose of humanity, we missed. But we saw later on the internet, because that you can do that. Oh, the big news is, okay, and I don't know if you're, this is the weird thing. Out of everything that happened that night, I got to the Netflix party, and right when I walk in, I see Cat Williams carrying his Emmy with his little crew there. I walk up to him, I'm like, how you doing? He goes, Marc Maron, you're one of the guys I want to work with. I'm like, wow, no shit, Mr. Williams. I call him Mr. Williams. He's like, yup. He's like, keep doing what you're doing. I'm like, will you come on the show sometime? He's like, anytime you're ready. And I'm like, okay. And then I walked away from that. And I'm like, I don't know how to get in touch with Cat Williams. I think he's tricky to get in touch with. I know he is. So I saw him again. And I said, how are we going to do this? He's like, well, let's just exchange numbers. I'm like, all right. So I pulled my phone out and then he sent a woman over to give me his number. So oddly, maybe not so much, that was a high point for me. Getting Cat Williams' phone number and knowing that could happen. That I just have to text him. I guess I have to do it when I'm ready. I think that was the condition. And only I can decide that. So Slash, wow, man. I didn't know, like, I'm a pretty big Guns N' Roses fan. And I like all their work. And I've always liked Slash. I liked his whole presentation. But I've never seen Guns N' Roses live, and I've listened to their records, and in most of the records, you know, outside of the bigger riffs, I'd like to hear the leads up front a little more. Like, I could not quite identify exactly from my history of listening to any of his stuff, like, exactly the nature of his style, you know, isolated as a fucking guitar player. I know he's great. I knew that from all the riffs and, you know, what I could hear, but... And, you know, and I like him a lot. And, you know, he came, we had a great talk. And it's sort of a little guitar nerdy, so prepare yourself. And I'm not even a full-on guitar nerd. I only know a few things. But I really like the guy. And I love his music. So that's given. But I'd never seen him live. So they asked me if I want to go to the Whiskey, as I mentioned earlier. So I go to the Whiskey to see Slash and Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators. Miles Kennedy, great singer. He's done a few records, his new record, which is good. He did with Miles Kennedy singing in his band. And I was real close to see Slash do his thing, man. And he came out, you know, with his top hat and his sunglasses and his Gibsons. But it was great to see him play. And just to hear him so isolated like that, I mean, Slash's job in this band is just, he's the lead guitar player, and he's like, you know, he's laying down the tunes, and you can hear he wrote some, and you can hear by him playing solo in a band that, you know, he's been with for a long time, just how much of Guns N' Roses is him, his pace, his tone, his riffs. But they didn't do, I think they only did one Guns song, and as I found out when I talked to Slash, it was originally his song from way back. They did Rocket Queen, which is one of my favorite fucking Guns N' Roses song. And he fucking did like a 7 to 10 minute solo in the middle of this thing, and it was astounding. The way he plays lead, he slouches down a little bit, and he almost literally sets the Les Paul on his knee to play it, so the neck is almost next to his face. And he just is all in to those strings, man, into his fingers. And I'd never seen, like, there was so much taste to it, so much style. You know, the blues were definitely there, and all the other Slash tricks and riffs and runs. And I was just fucking blown away. Stayed through the whole show. Anyways, this is me talking to Slash. Solidly one of the greatest rock guitar players ever. Oh, yeah, and his new album, Living the Dream, featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, comes out tomorrow, September 21st. You can get it wherever you get music, and it's a great fucking rock record. Okay, me and Slash. Do you have any of those, the Gold Tops?
Actually, I just used, well, I don't know what year that one.
It's a reissue. It's a Gibson reissue, the 56.
Yeah. Okay, well, I used a real, I mean, it's just funny that you bring that up, because I used
on the new record?
A 56 on the new record.
That's what that is?
Yeah.
Like, I knew it.
Well, not every song. Like,
but
the opening song.
Right.
And you can tell, because it's brighter and
yeah,
more,
man.
But I needed that sound, and I had that guitar. I've never recorded with it. I've had it for years. I've had it since, like, 1992
Holy shit.
Or something. So I dragged it out, and it ended up on like 5 or 6 songs.
I just said to her, man, I was just listening to it in there. I'm like, the guitar sounds different. It sounds more like raw and weird, one of these.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what you did.
So you recognize that.
I fucking recognize it right away, because I was like, what did he do?
That's cool. I feel much more comfortable now. I'm talking to a guitar nerd.
Right. I wish I was more of one, but I do know, like, I'm kind of pure.
Yeah, but still, to be able to pick out that guitar.
Well, this, like, when I got turned on to that guitar, like I was a Fender guy. You know, I'm like, I'm no wizard on there. I like to play straight through. I'm not a pedal guy. Like, that's an old 57 Deluxe right there.
Yeah, which is basically what I used, well, not on the whole record, but there's a song I use the exact same model.
Really?
There's a song called, hold on, bear with me, The Great Pretender, which is like the third to last song on the record.
And you just went straight in?
That with a 58, no, with a 59 Les Paul.
The 59,
yeah,
like a sunburst?
I'm not an effects guy either. I don't do pedals. I mean, occasionally you'll have a phase for something, but...
Right.
But yeah, 59...
Was it sunburst?
Yeah.
Like Michael Bloomfield used to play?
Yeah,
Fuck, man. Like a real one?
A real one. Yeah, I've had it for years, and I've only used it in one session. So on this record...
That's
crazy. For the most part, I used a 58, a 59... the 56 Gold Top, and then I also have this one guitar that I've had for years, which is, we just call it the Dara guitar, which is a handmade 59 replica that a guy named Chris Derrick made back in 1985, and I got a hold of it in 1986, and I used it on the first Guns record, and it's just one of my, it's been my go-to recording guitar ever since.
And it's just a replica some dude made?
Back then they didn't do reissues.
Right.
So he used to make these really incredible 59 replicas, and they're actually really valuable now.
So who, like, what you got, nicotine gum?
Yes, I do.
Oof.
Yeah.
I was on lozenges for a decade, and the nicotine lozenges.
You know, I quit smoking 9 years ago.
Yeah.
Almost 10 years ago. And I had pneumonia. I was just talking to Rick Nielsen about it on my way here, because he just had pneumonia. And pneumonia is what helped me quit smoking. That, and
it,
I saw Cher
you.
The night before, and that's when I caught the pneumonia. So Cher helped me quit smoking.
Yeah.
Anyway, So I couldn't smoke.
Yeah.
I mean, I tried. I couldn't breathe. I just couldn't. So I had 2 weeks on
it's
my back.
It's what you do try.
You know, that's you do try.
Yeah.
So I quit, and then I used the patch to sort of get the edge off, and I then I started doing the snus thing.
The snus,
and I was doing that. For
I would
years.
Go to sleep with it.
I did.
I sleep with snus in my
and
mouth.
And my significant other talked me out of doing it, and so I started doing the gum, and I sleep with the gum.
Sure. I mean that. Like, I was off the lozenges just between me and you and whoever's listening to this. I've been smoking fucking cigars, right? So I've been off cigarettes for, same as you, 10 days, about 10 years. Yeah. And then I was on the fucking lozenges for almost like 8 years. And I would sleep with them. Then I would do snus. And then I'd fucking do dip pouches.
Yeah.
Right? And then I got off everything for a while. And then I just started smoking cigars. Now, like, two of them. Yeah. I'm a fucking junkie like that. It's just like, it's going to be my, one thing.
You
man.
Know, all things considered, it's my last real vice.
Right.
So I'm sort of like, I mean, I know that if I really put my mind to it, I could just quit like I would with anything.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel... But
I don't feel like, what's the reason? Oh, she said, it can't be good for you. And
that's right. Yeah, that's...
It's got to be bad for your blood pressure or something. I'm like, well, you know, until someone reads me a scathing report about...
But isn't that fucked up about snus though too? Like, with the snus, didn't you think like this is safe somehow? Like it's better than chewing tobacco?
And you weren't... Yeah, and you weren't spitting into a cup and doing all that kind of stuff, but then your teeth start to get loose. And
what was it? I found someone that like it was some other brand that was like triple strong, and it was like I'd get up with coffee and put one in, and I have to sit down for a while.
It was fun.
But that's just the nature of it, man.
It is. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine, a musician.
Yeah,
who's another blues guy, and he had some, you know, he's had some drugs and alcohols and all. So he just got his shit together, and so we're sitting at Jerry's Deli and we're talking about, you know, like you know how hard alcohol is and how hard smack is and all this stuff. But then the one thing that we both said about cigarettes, man, that's the tough one.
Yeah, because they keep coming around. They're kind of available.
Well, you get nicotine. These triggers all the time. Like they only last for maybe, I don't know, 2 seconds or something, but they're really, really potent.
Right.
And you could just get it watching somebody smoke on TV. I saw somebody smoking at a bus stop, and I was like, oh. Yeah. It happens at least once a day, every day.
Well, I think that it's rare, too, you see people smoking.
Yeah.
I was just in Chicago. Fucking everyone still smokes. They didn't get the memo, man. They're just fat dudes smoking cigarettes outside everywhere.
The problem is I was a compulsive smoker. I chain smoked. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't handle, this is not why I quit smoking, but I couldn't handle not being able to smoke wherever I wanted.
Yeah.
It just really, I was in Calabasas one time. It was one of the first times I'd ever actually been there.
Yeah.
And I went to, there's like some sort of outdoor mall-y kind of thing with a theater. It's like a pavilion or something.
Right.
And I got out of the car and I lit a cigarette and I was walking wherever we were walking to through the parking lot. And they said, you can't smoke in here.
Yeah.
I said, what do you mean smoking here? I'm fucking out here. This is out here.
Yeah.
And it was like, there's a rule. You can't smoke
it's
on
a law.
The street.
Right. Yeah.
And I was, and so enough of that kind of stuff. And I was smoking at gigs and I was on tour in the UK.
Yeah.
And they told me, said, yeah, well, the smoking ban's coming. I said, you guys are going to have some serious problems. I was in Ireland. You're gonna have some, they're gonna riot. It's not gonna work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, didn't finish the tour. And while I was, came back like maybe 6 months later, and they had passed this thing.
Yeah.
And there was people sitting outside all smoking their cigarettes with their cocktails.
Yeah.
And sitting on benches. And some hotels had put monitors outside so you could watch TV and smoke. And they just went down quietly.
Wow. Everyone did.
And it was like, wow. And, you know, no repercussions whatsoever. No violence. No, you know, the stoning or anything.
Well, I think it's because there's a fundamental shame to people who are addicted to things that they know in their heart are bad for you.
Yeah. So like, you think that's what it is?
What are they going to really fight for? It's like, can't we have the right to kill ourselves inside?
Like, cause I think, and can we take down everybody that doesn't smoke with us?
Exactly. Yeah, right. Because like after a certain point, you know, when you wake up and it's like, you hear your lungs, but you, like you said, like you had pneumonia and you tried to smoke. Like after a certain point, you know you're fucked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, I mean, all things considered, they were finding me for every cigarette. They were trying to find me for every cigarette I smoked on stage. like, oh, the
venues?
Yeah. So it was like $100 for every cigarette. And so we had to make up a bunch of stories and we got out of it. But I mean, I couldn't believe it had gotten to that point.
That was part of the bill.
Right. Yeah.
Well, let's talk, like, who are those blues guys? When you listen to blues guys, because I have some questions. We can talk about your life a little bit, but I have guitar questions just because, like, I'm not as deep a nerd. But, like, because you have a lot of guitars, mm-hmm. you play mostly Les Pauls,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But at the beginning, to get the tone you wanted, did you fuck with the electronics or did you just do amp and guitar shit?
I've always been, it's a deep question. All right, because when I first started, it was just, I think I had a little Fender Princeton. It was a little Fender combo thing. And the first guitar, the electric guitar that I had was a Memphis Les Paul copy. This was, I guess it was 1980.
Yeah.
Right? So,
did you just start playing?
I just started playing, yeah. So I was like, I started playing when I was, right around my birthday, so 14 going on 15, and mm-hmm. then so I had an acoustic guitar that I learned on,
yeah,
with a one string on it, so I learned all these one string riffs. And then I had this cool guitar teacher in town, that guy named Robert Wolin, who was great, who taught me how to put the other strings on and some other
how'd
cool
you find
shit.
The guitar teacher,
he just, there was a music school on Fairfax and Santa Monica.
Well, okay, so let's go back and get come around to this. So, but you weren't born here?
No, I was born in Stoke-on-Trent. I was born in Hampstead, London.
Right, so you were a British guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And your
mom? Half. My mom's American.
Right. So. And she was in show business?
Well, she's a clothes designer, and so she did all entertainers.
Was she around? Is she around still?
No, she passed away.
I'm sorry.
Right around the time that I quit smoking.
Oh, really?
Because she died of lung cancer.
Oh, fuck.
Because she was one of those smokers that always said, I'm going to quit one day. And then,
oh, and you had to watch that?
Yeah, it was bad. But you know what? While she was in the hospital, not to go back to this, but I would literally sit with her, go outside, smoke a cigarette, come back, sit with her. And then the Cher thing happened, and that's when I said, you know what?
you were just at a Cher concert. She's not personally responsible.
Yeah, but I had to leave for every song and go outside and smoke. No, go outside and smoke.
Oh.
And I think I'd worn myself down from smoking so much, and Cher just took me over the top.
Oh, yeah, that was...
She revisited one of those periods, she had a closet on stage, and she'd go into the closet and she'd come out and she'd be the Indian, and then she'd come out and she'd be the...
For Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves?
Every single thing that she's been over her, you know, epic career. And it was, it started with the Sonny and Cher thing, it just killed me. I couldn't take it. So I would smoke every 2 seconds.
Killed you in a good way or a bad way?
Bad way. I just didn't have any fond memories of that show or any of the other stuff, you know.
But your mom, she did
her clothes.
She costumed entertainers?
Yeah, so she did. I mean, my mom did a lot of people. Cher was one of them. Helen Reddy was another one. Dinah Ross.
Oh, that's why you're at the show.
David Bowie, No, that's not why I was at the Cher show.
Why were you at the Cher show?
Oh, because my ex and her buddies wanted to go and drag me along in Vegas.
Oh, okay.
All places. Yeah, right? So she did all these people, David Bowie, John Lennon.
Really?
I could go. This is a long list. Sylvester. Remember Sylvester?
Yeah.
Stevie Wonder.
And she would.
But also Flip Wilson. A lot of.
He wore like almost a tux on stage, Flip Wilson. So she was like the person, it sounds like.
Yeah, she was a pretty hot chick.
What was her name?
Ola Hudson.
And so which, do you know which period of Bowie or Lennon or was it?
Oh, with Bowie.
I just saw that exhibit. Did you see it?
No, she's in it.
Oh, yeah.
Her clothes are in it. I mean, they have her thing of her clothes.
Oh, yeah.
She did the cool period when he was the thin white Duke, the suits.
Oh, yeah, the white suits.
That was her thing.
Oh, wow, yeah. So you lived in London how long, or England?
I moved permanently to L.A. in 1971, I guess, 1970.
Because I think we're like the same age.
How old are you? 65.
I'm 63.
Okay.
So now your real name's Saul,
mm-hmm.
but are you a Jew?
No.
No? No, you got no Jew in you?
No, but I'm in the book of Jewish famous people. For you know, so that, funny.
Well, I thought I'd heard you're half Jew. I'm full Jew. I thought maybe he's half Jew, but you just got Jew name.
No, I got a Jew name. I mean, if you were to ask my dad about it, he was talking about King Saul.
Yeah, okay.
And so it's a different thing.
Isn't that Old Testament? Or
I'm not really good with
it. It's Jew. It's pretty Jew. And your dad?
Plus, all my friends are Jewish, so I'm honorary.
What'd your dad do?
He's a graphic designer and photographer, artist. But
is he still around?
He's still around, yeah.
Uh-huh.
But during this time, he was doing all the album covers for Asylum Records. So we lived in Little Canyon.
Yeah.
When I first moved to LA, that's where we lived. So we were in the midst of that whole...
In 71?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
very
crazy.
Very exciting.
Where you just see, like, you know, David Crosby stumbling down the street.
Well, you know, like, and Joni Mitchell was our, like, my mom did her clothes. My dad did all
Zappa.
The covers. Zappa's down the street.
Yeah.
I used to love the Swans. He had this big lake.
Who did? Zappa?
Zappa. His house was on the corner of Laurel and...
Woodrow Wilson?
Lookout Mountain.
Oh, okay.
And so there was the big, huge, tall shrubbery that surrounded the whole thing. But if you peeked inside, there was a lake in there, and he had swans. And
no
I
kidding.
Was just, because swans, they have swans in England all the place. So that was like my thing.
Oh, that was cool. It made you feel at home?
Yeah.
Were these people coming and going when you were a kid? Or were your dad, were they in that scene? Your folks?
We were all in that scene, yeah. You know, we were always at the Troubadour, and there was, you know, like we're talking about Linda Ronstadt. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So we had all the Eagles guys.
Yeah, sure.
I didn't know who the Eagles would be at the time, but it all turned out to be the Eagles.
Right? It's funny. I didn't realize till recently that the Troubadour was sort of a low-key trip. I mean, it was like kind of singer-songwriter.
It was the spot.
Laid back.
Yeah, it was
It wasn't hard rock, though.
No. Singer-songwriter. I mean, the biggest thing that happened at the Troubadour when I was a little kid was Elton John played.
Right.
And everybody talked about it. I didn't go, but everybody talked about it, and that was like, you know, sort of a seminal LA moment.
Talked to Walsh the other day, Joe.
Yeah, Joe's great.
He's another guy, just like what a chameleon sort of like guitar story. He's like, he's always sort of at these weird junctures, giving people guitars, hanging out.
Joe's great. Joe, and he's one of my all-time favorite guitar players. He's probably
really?
Not listening to this, so I'll say all kinds of nice things about him.
Now, I don't know if they'll listen to it. He's one of those guys where his kid got him over here.
Kid's
like, you got to go do this cool thing. So I had Joe over here. You know, he's pretty fucking sober, too.
Yeah.
And he...
No, I know. I know Joe very well through a lot of that.
And yeah.
So
you do the thing.
I mean, I finally succumbed to that. There was a point there, and so the word surrendered to it, and I did. I followed it to a letter. I've been sort of out of it for a long time too. Because
I
follow it myself.
That's the way. If you program your brain, and you got good. I got 19 the other day.
Really?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
August 9th.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, pal. How long are you?
I have 12 years.
That's good, right?
Years, yeah.
Holy shit.
No one would have ever predicted that.
No. you were headed for the box.
Yeah, but
yeah.
But there was a point there where you know, it just, you know, the glory days are gone. You cannot relive them
anymore.
And you can try. You keep shooting for that. It's just never going to happen.
But dude, when you see dudes your age like still at it, alive.
I was at a wedding recently.
Yeah.
And some guy who was my age, if not probably older, asked me if I wanted to do a bump. I was walking down a flight of stairs, and he came up alongside me and said, "Hey, you want to do a bump?" I was like, "What?" Because I hadn't, it just, and he said, "You know, a bump." And I was like, no, I'm good. But it was weird. And then I had another.
But do you remember hearing that in like 1984?
Normal.
It was the most exciting question.
Yeah. It was expected. It was the question you were waiting for. Otherwise, you're going to have to ask people.
Yeah, right. You hold them. What do you got?
We used to call you, are you William?
Are you William? Is that what it's called? Yeah.
Anyway.
We used to say, you got a bindle?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good times.
So, yeah. So about the guitars.
So you got here. You're living in Laurel Canyon. You're a kid. But I think what's interesting to me is that, you know, you were immersed in a creative community. You come from it. There was probably never any sort of like, you shouldn't do this or that.
No.
That you were always encouraged to kind of.
There was also a whole philosophy that my dad had about raising kids, which was to treat them as adults, right?
Yeah.
So I had a certain kind. I do, but he didn't come around until 7 years after I was born, so he's a little younger than me. So I was raised with a ton of sort of freedom, you know, sort of like, I think it was a Spock thing at the time.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Treat him like adults,
so
basically?
Yeah. So I just was sort of running around in this crazy... I mean, looking back on it, it was really, really cool. People were really, really cool.
Right.
It was a different time.
Yeah.
Really intelligent, very creative, and outside of the system and just doing their thing. So it was very inspired and whatnot. So it was good, but I never had any aspirations to actually become a musician.
No, what were you thinking?
So, I mean, like, the only real sort of natural talent that I had was drawing.
Uh-huh.
but I
and
didn't.
The old man did that, so the pencils were around.
Yeah, so I was always drawing, and I actually did a kid's book with Joni Mitchell that never got released.
Which was really cool. A kid?
Yeah, so I did the drawings, and she did the poems.
Do you still have a copy of it?
My dad does. Oh. I don't.
Oh, I think everybody wants to see that. You know, you know, Keith Richards wrote a kid's book with his daughter.
Oh, no way.
He did. It's really? Out. Yeah, it's. I can't remember what it's called, but I talked to him about it at the end of the interview. I was just like, I didn't know. I was like, how's it being a grandpa?
Did he write the
he did some of the I can't remember exactly.
He's one of my, as all the musicians at least that I know, he's my favorite. I think he's the funniest. I think he's got the best fucking dry wit out of anybody.
And he's so fucking smart, you know. Yeah, I don't know how long you've known him or what your relationship is with him, but but I was just a fan. Like, he was my guy when I was a kid. I was like, who didn't want to be Keith? Yeah. Like, and he's why I smoked.
Oh, no, that's
he's
just
why I drank Jack Daniels.
Oh, okay.
My first guitar was a Telecaster.
I when I first met him, I was 13 years old.
Really?
How the
fuck did that happen?
Seymour Cassell.
Oh,
back in the day
him?
When they all used to go to Seymour's house. Okay, this is another story altogether.
Yeah.
Seymour has a son named Matt. He's got a couple kids, but Matt was my best friend in high school.
Oh.
And so, if you know anything about Seymour,
he's one of Cassavetti's guys.
Yeah, he's one of that little team. So they were pretty hard edge, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we used to hang out there. And that's where he's the one that named me Slash. That's where the name Slash came from.
Really?
Yeah. So we used to hang out there. And I didn't find this out until the 90s, because he just called me Slash and it just became a nickname.
Yeah.
But I asked him why in the 90s. He goes, because you were always hustling and you were always going on the move. You never stopped to talk. You never stopped to hang out. So it was always a whiz going by. So he just said, go Slash.
Yeah, right. And that's
and
it.
I was like, that's it? That's
it. Stuck,
you know. But so Seymour used to live behind the Riot House on Sunset, and there's a house that was tucked away in this end of this long driveway covered in like trees and shit,
right?
And then there's an A-frame in between, and so they had some notorious weekend stuff, and when Stones would come into town, that's where they would go.
No shit.
So I got to be friends at a young age with Ronnie, and that's how I met Keith.
Yeah.
And
Ronnie
Wood.
Really? Yeah. So they were already,
so friends of Seymour. So we would go to Stone shows, and so Keith was always a hero, and he was always very bigger than life. I didn't really get to be what you call friends with him until after, you know, in the 90s.
All right, so you're here and you're drawing.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, we went through, I mean, this is a very much hand to mouth, you know, living paycheck to paycheck.
Kind your old man?
Yeah, both of them.
Really?
Yeah, because there was work and then there wasn't work and then when work would come,
nine to five.
That's right.
Anyway,
so I was just doing whatever and trying to sort of fit in at school, which I had an issue with all the way up until I started playing guitar. And that was...
What do you mean? Like, you were just... who were you hanging out with? Like, the bad kids? Or
just
nobody?
I never fit into that whole thing. Mainstream public school, there was no corner that I fit into.
Or maybe just in your skin in general.
Yeah. I mean, I was okay.
Yeah, you
know,
you felt
all things
all
right? considered, I was all right. I didn't have a lot of issues. You know, I was half black and half white and half British, and that was sort of weird.
Did you have an accent at the beginning?
Yeah, back then I was like, And I think I worked. I made an effort to get rid of it, you know.
Sure.
But, you know, for everything else, I was the same t-shirts and jeans, long hair and all that. But then I just stumbled on the guitar without even knowing that much about it. I used to get turned on to going to see bands set up at the Troub and Starwood and all that.
And you could get in because you were so-and-so's kid.
Well, because back then I was with my parents because that's where they were.
Right, but you probably knew, like they all knew, the people that were involved at the Troub.
Sort of knew, there's a Slash. I wasn't Slash then.
Yeah. But you were Saul?
Yeah. So then Steve Adler I met. I was racing bikes. I was racing BMX at this time. Like when I was like 13.
So that was your crew?
To be a motocross. I was aspiring motocross guy. And I met Steven, and Steven had an electric guitar at his house. And he used to just crank it up and bang on it.
Hollywood kid?
No, he's from fucking Cleveland.
Yeah.
But then on top of that, he was from Cleveland, but he lived in Reseda.
So was he older than you, or was he with his
folks? About the same age. He's like a couple months older than me. And his mom kicked him out, and so he had to stay at his grandparents in West Hollywood, and that's when we met. And so I got turned on because he played guitar. I thought, you know, that sort of kid fantasy thing. And I was at that stage where you start doing air guitar at a Cheap Trick.
Sure,
and
yeah.
That. So I thought, well, I guess I'll play bass, but I didn't know anything about playing bass. Right. So I went to that music school.
Yeah. Other than without any strings.
Well, I didn't have an instrument then.
Right.
So then while I was sitting there talking to Robert, the teacher, he was playing guitar and he was playing Clapton stuff. And I was like, that's what I want to do. And he goes, that's not bass, that's lead guitar. And
right.
I was, that's what I want to do. So that's when I went and found that one string guitar.
And so you never
in
played
the closet.
Bass at
never,
all.
Never did. I do now sometimes.
Sure. Right?
But anyway, so that, and then it was the hugest turn on. I mean, even like that just playing a couple notes that actually sounded like right. something. It was just woo.
Yeah, know, yeah.
The heavens parted and all that.
Like what Clapton stuff?
That was, it was Disraeli Years.
Oh, yeah.
That record.
All right, so you have this cathartic moment, and then you're like, I'm going to be a guitar player.
Right. And then to go back to your
tone.
Thing, I got an electric guitar, and the first thing I did was take that little Princeton, and I had the Les Paul copy,
right.
and I got one of those MXR Distortion Pluses.
Oh, those are great. The shit brown one? The
yeah,
beige.
It was like a puke green, yellow kind of thing. And that was,
I think I have
that
one.
Was that moment where I was like, oh.
The MXR Distortion Plus, it was like a,
And I, and now, you know, I started that, learning about what everybody's using. And
but
how,
that specific sound, that's true. Cause like, you know, you kind of held that for a while.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, I think all I've been doing ever since then is just trying to do what it is that turned me on in the first place.
Yeah,
I mean, there's
right.
you never perfect it, so
right.
you're just constantly trying to, you know.
Right. It's like drugs, but like, sure, so you're that young, and that first time you turn that MXR Distortion Plus on, it's a very specific type of distortion, that
yeah.
one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah,
and it's a little compressed.
It's a little it's a little compressed. I mean, when you're 14, 15 years old,
like,
and you do
annoyed.
It, it's like, wow. And then you sort of, you know, slowly but surely graduate from there. But the one thing about music and about guitar sounds that's different from drugs is that there are always plateaus that you can reach, and it can,
well, yeah, there's
and
a, there's
it goes
a,
on forever. With drugs, you hit it one place. Usually,
right.
in the first couple of weeks, you started doing it,
yeah.
and it's all downhill.
Right. Exactly, and there's no real skill set. It's not you're like you can,
well, that's something else altogether. But just because you said like drugs,
sure,
you
know, the
like,
feeling, well, the endorphin, the rush.
Yeah.
But yeah, you don't have to. You're not going to kind of evolve the way you use drugs to a degree where it's like I'm really getting creative with this. You do, but it's not taking you anywhere. You know what I mean? You're not. It's not like learning flamenco. Guitar,
yeah.
right?
No, it's not at all.
You know, you,
I think you cook it up, and that's about as far as you're going to get.
I've really nailed this. I've taken this wherever it needs to go. So how long? Wait, I guess the question at this point for me is that, like, in terms of natural ability versus like practicing your ass off. I mean, you can have a feel and stuff, but how much do you like in order for you to get from the beginning there? What were you learning? What were you? How were you practicing to get to where you got to?
Well, I mean, I was learning. I mean, that guy Robert, you know, he said he was going to, you know, he's going to teach me guitar lessons, right? So you start out like you're probably, I don't know if you ever took piano lessons, but the same kind of thing, scales and this and that. And
you can read music?
No, because I didn't do this for very long.
Right.
But I gave it the college try, and I learned a lot from watching him play. And he goes, well, if you can learn this lesson by next week, I'll teach you any song you want me to teach you. So I was like, okay, cool. So, you know, I mean, I was listening to Zeppelin and Sabbath and Aerosmith and Cheap Trick. And, I had the Stones and Beatles and The Who and like all those tons of records.
That first Aerosmith record
stuff.
Is underrated.
It is underrated. But, you know, all things considered. You know what's wrong with that record is it didn't sound in 1973, it didn't sound as good as other records did in 1973.
Uh-huh.
That was the problem.
Yeah.
Songs were great. Playing was
nice,
great.
Loose.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. No,
really,
it was all awesome.
Thing,
but just sonically, I think that's why it didn't cross over like it should have. Anyway, so I can't remember what the first riff I had him teach me was, but I watched him do it. He put the record on and he put the guitar and he just sat there and listened to it and figured out the notes. So I thought, I can do that. And so I eventually left there, with all due respect to Robert,
because
I learned a lot of cool things. Some picking techniques.
Scales? Pentatonics?
No, just up and down picking. pentatonic stuff. Yeah. Well, just because learning those licks off of a record.
Yeah, that's where I stop. Pentatonic, and I'm good.
Yeah. I mean,
you can play blues here, and then move it down two, and then it's major.
Yeah. Well, you start. Yeah, yeah. Well, see, I mean, you put some thought into it. There's theory behind that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I quit with the lessons, and I just started learning. So I was learning, you know, Keith and Mick stuff.
Yeah.
And Mick Taylor. And
open
Keith
chords.
Richards. Open chord stuff. Some of it. I didn't go all the way down to like with Keith. He's got a lot of open chord technique.
Yeah.
Which didn't totally interest me.
Right.
You know, I know more of it now than I did then.
Yeah.
But a lot of Mick Taylor single note lead stuff. That was a big thing. So Can't You Hear Me Knocking? Like, oof. Is there just like that solo? You know, I mean,
and that's all
things that, I never had to listen to anything else.
That's Mick Taylor.
Yeah.
And it's a regular tuning.
Yeah.
Oh. So you sat down. You were one of those guys sort of learned the leads.
Yeah. So
you
I was
everybody's
learning everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And you had an ear for it and you figured it out.
Yeah.
Hours.
Yeah.
Hours.
I was the guitar and I were inseparable.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to walk around with one of those little, what was it?
Walkman?
No.
It was the Rockman? Walkman.
The fucking tape deck.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Boombox?
Yeah. I mean, it was like Panasonic.
Oh, yeah. The one with the handle?
Yeah. And that and some cassettes that I used to steal from Tower Records.
Right.
And I was just in my guitar and I was, you know.
What was like when you started playing, what was like the guitarist that you were sort of learning? Who was the real, you know, portal? Like, was like, what guitarist like blew you the fuck
there
away?
There was a few of them. Mick Taylor, I named was one. Jimmy Page was another. Old Eric Clapton was one. Hendrix was one. That was all sort of going on. Oh, and Aerosmith. I mean, there was an Aerosmith record called Rocks.
Yeah, sure.
And I credit them for, that was the record that I identified with attitude-wise.
Yeah.
And so that was an important one for me. I mean, that sort of set me in the direction that I ended up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Rocks
that
did.
Sort of really loose, drunken, aggressive, misfit fucking rock and roll thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a different production too, huh?
Yeah, it's you can tell it was right before everything took over.
Yeah.
When they were still having fun with all the, you know, even Jack Douglas, who produced it, somebody I know pretty well, they were all just having a good time, you know, and just decided to make the heaviest rock and roll record. And they did, you know, it's really bassy and muddy. And
you're friends with those guys now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Perry's like, he's the both of those. I think the other guy, he doesn't get enough credit.
Brad?
Yeah.
No, Brad's major. I mean, there was Brad, I think Brad.
Whitford?
Brad and Joe collectively were one of the best dual guitar teams. But Brad's playing was so different than Joe's it was like very much lick oriented, whereas Joe's is lick oriented too, but he had a lot of dynamic, you know, like a sort of a punch here or a dive bomb there.
Right.
That's a whole different kind of trip.
And he plays in his own zone. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like
he's so unorthodox just the way that he plays. And he uses the same fingers everybody else does, but just the way that he fingers stuff is very different.
And what did you feel about in terms of like knowing that relationship between, because like, you know, a relationship that Keith has with Ronnie is obviously it's like was meant to be, Ronnie and Keith.
No, it works.
You know, Keith and Mick, you understand why that didn't quite last.
Right.
But like with Izzy, did you have that with him?
Yeah, well, I don't know what other guys do. Still to this day, I don't know what other dual guitar. Like,
yeah.
For me, it was always like, you know, I play my thing, you play your thing. And we never sat down really and worked stuff out.
Right.
It was just jamming. And we sort of knew what the chord changes was. Or we wrote something.
Yeah.
I'd play it this way and he'd play it that way. And it just worked.
Right.
And that was about as much effort as ever went into it. And so even with guitar players that I work with, like in my band or in the Guns N' Roses, I'm playing with Richard now, it's really, I hate to sort of sit there and studiously work out guitar harmonies or like these sort of like perfect guitar
passages.
No. So I think, you know, listening back to guys that came around doing the dual guitar thing way before we did, it seems for the most part, the bands that I like anyway, it sounds very natural.
Right.
It doesn't sound thought out.
Well, it's funny because like when you realize that everybody's following Keith, which seems like insanity, but like... But
Keith
they are
is always following Charlie,
right? But their relationship is sort of like I think it goes back and forth because sometimes I've read that Charlie's sort of like watching Keith,
because he might keep trying to go from being behind the beat,
right?
You know,
yeah,
that can turn the whole thing around,
right? So there was a language there.
Well, that's what makes a unique chemistry.
Sure.
Because that doesn't necessarily, other people get freaked out. Like, but, I can't
right.
adhere to that fucking lack of commitment to structure.
Yeah.
But some people just get up and jam and they can speak to each other without even, you know, just playing and sort of inherently or instinctively, go into the thing that he expects the other guy to do.
Right.
And if it doesn't happen that way, he can react accordingly. And it's just that kind of natural synergy is what makes us, a band like the Stones different than another band.
And also, I guess the players, like, it's better if they have, like, if they really have a voice on the thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know,
it's important. I mean, well, especially for a rock and roll band where guitar is one of the main instruments of the whole thing.
Right.
I mean, it's the other lead instrument. You know, you got your bass and drums. And so it needs to. These guys need to be able to speak.
Right.
I mean, it needs to be a personal voice.
It can't just be a guy who's just a kind of.
Well, here's the chorus. I'm reading along.
I
went to. I saw Philharmonic last night with John Williams, and you see those guys play. And I mean, okay, we're talking about an orchestra. Okay, I understand why everybody needs to cue. All right.
Right.
But in a rock and roll band, you've got you know, a sort of very personal artist with a certain voice that needs
I mean, there's only four chords,
three
or four chords, right? I mean, like, that's the weird thing about when that changed my mind about thinking about playing, is that, like, for a long time it was three chords really for the most part, and you know, everybody, you know, it's not how fast or what you play, it's if you are speaking with the thing.
I mean, listen, the most important thing, you know, guitar players, God, it's guitar is a very competitive, like, everybody, especially nowadays, everybody's trying to be, you know, they've got their techniques down, their speed, their this, their that. It reminds me of X Games, where it's just like how much you can wow people. But really what's important is to be able to express yourself, be able to sing or speak, you know, with your own voice and to be recognized as yourself.
Right.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
You know,
if it's three notes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's really what matters, is be yourself and have that translate and have it, and people might pick up on it or they might not, but at least you're being honest.
Right. You know? And that's what you learn from the blues guys, right? You know, from Freddie, Albert, BB, and
all the Kings. Those are the three Kings are my favorite blues guys.
Yeah. So when did you and Adler start playing in a band? That was
we had a couple different bands. We had
But
they weren't really full fledged bands. There was always a member missing. And usually it was the singer.
So you played with him for a while. So how did Guns? I'm sure you've told the story a million times, but not to me. I was in LA. I was a doorman at the Comedy Store in 1986. But, like, you guys were it then, right? So when did you join those cats?
I started working, I had a group with Steven, and then I had a group with Steven and Duff.
Yeah.
For a short amount of time. Couldn't find a singer.
Duff's cleaned up too, huh?
Yeah, he got clean before I did. He's got a few years before I did. And then I met Izzy, and Izzy had a thing with Axl, and I saw Axl with Izzy later. It's hard for me to remember exactly.
What kind of player is Izzy? Like, I can't seem to.
Well, when I first met him, he was. What's it? I mean,
he seemed more Keithy.
It was like Keith, Johnny Thunders.
Oh yeah, Johnny Thunders.
A little
That's
bit
right.
more
That's
electric.
Right.
Than
yeah,
Keith.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it definitely had a very. Like, he was, I always say knee slides. It was a guy that doing power chords and knee slides.
Yeah, right.
And it was really, really cool. And then, so those guys had a band, obviously. Then I ended up, we all met. Axl had a band called Hollywood Rose, and I joined up with him.
Yeah.
And Izzy was in it, and Izzy quit. And so Steven
again?
Like the first time.
Okay.
And so Steven and Axl and a guy named Steve Darrow, great bass player, very big Alice Cooper influence guy.
Yeah.
And so we had a band called Hollywood Rose, and that split up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so all these different things
and
happened.
This is all in there, what, 82, 83?
No, this is like 84.
Okay.
83, 84.
Yeah.
And then Axl had Hollywood Rose and this guy Tracy had this band called LA Guns, and they merged and became Guns N' Roses. And then Duff, after working with Steve and I, he was living across the street from Izzy, so he ended up joining Guns N' Roses. And then Axl and I talked at one point, and he goes, I guess he had a falling out with Tracy. So yeah. I said, well, I wanted to come back and do it. So I started working in it. And then the drummer, there was this gig that we were going to do. We were going to do a tour up to of the Pacific Northwest, because Duff is from up there and he knew all the venues.
Right.
And so when the original drummer guy heard about this, he said, I'm not going up there with you guys.
Why? Too out of control?
Totally out of control.
Yeah.
It probably didn't feel stable enough for him.
Yeah.
So I called Steven, and Steven came in,
great, we're all out of control.
And then we went up to do these gigs up north, and the car broke down in Bakersfield, so we hitchhiked up there, and that was really what
with
cemented
your
this band. Well, we left the band and the equipment in the U-Haul.
Yeah.
And we had two guys that were sort of like roadies, friends of ours.
Yeah.
And they were going to get the car fixed and meet us up there. They never did. So we borrowed this band that Duff knows equipment called the Fastbacks, and we did one show.
Yeah.
They tried to not pay us.
In San Francisco?
No, this was in Seattle.
Yeah.
And then we got a ride back, and we were together after that from that point on.
So the car ride was the bonding experience?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the whole experience was pretty bonding.
So when did you start, what were you doing drug-wise from then?
Where did it start? Realistically, in all honesty, it was mostly booze.
Yeah.
I wasn't a coke guy then. I had a bad experience with coke on my birthday trying to play after doing like a gram or something in my head. And from that point on, I was always sort of indifferent about coke. So mostly drinking then. I didn't get into the other stuff, because the other stuff, drug of choice, was the obvious
dope.
Yeah. And that didn't happen until like 1985
right around when you guys were working on Appetite.
Yeah, right before we got a record deal.
Yeah.
Or not right before.
But it seems like that. LA at that time, because it's interesting, you were able to witness the sort of intimacy of that Laurel Canyon thing, and LA was a small town musically in a lot of ways when you were growing up.
Yeah.
And even in the 80s, it seemed like, if you watch that Decline in Western Civilization.
I love that movie.
It's great. Yeah. But all you guys knew each other, right? I mean, there was just this battle of the bands every fucking night in this city.
Yeah, and we were definitely the only five guys in town that could have made up that band.
Yeah.
Because we all hated pretty much what the 80s scene in LA was about.
Because it was too fluffy?
It was too fluffy. It was contrived. It was totally... everybody was getting the look together.
Yeah.
None of them had any real chops
right.
or any real background
right.
or had any real music history.
So you guys were you were the bitter, angry dudes?
I guess we were a little angry.
Yeah. Honoring the rock of the monsters.
Yeah.
I
think a lot of it, there was just a general attitude.
So hair metal was what you were up against.
Yeah. And so we went in, going in, just doing our thing against... It was us against everybody else.
Right. You know? It's so funny because I know John Daniel. Do you know John Daniel?
I'm trying to think who
he
that
was
is.
The bass player in Candy.
Oh, okay.
And now he's in music management, but he's Gilby, like him and Gilby were buddies.
Candy. That's
I
remember, it's funnily enough, we played Madame Wong's one time, and Candy was playing, and that's how I first became aware of Gilby.
Yeah.
So it's funny because when Gilby came into the whole thing, that's where I remembered him from.
Right, from Candy.
He'd be perfect because there was a lot of guitar players that had this sort of dyed black hair, sort of Johnny Thunders, whatever kind of thing going.
Ryan Roxy?
Yeah.
what was his band? What was Ryan Roxy in? Do you remember?
I can't remember. I played with him. He was in Snake Pit for a little bit.
Yeah.
But I can't remember exactly
where
he had
came
going
from. Yeah.
But it was a similar kind of a thing. It's a certain guitar player kind of look.
Thing. So when you guys come out with Appetite, you're up against all that shit. It's a different trip, right? Mm. And didn't it when you first released, didn't it take a couple of years before it popped? Wasn't there a weird story around it?
Well, I mean, Guns was probably a good example of a band that nobody really wanted to see happen except for the people that were directly involved with it. We had a manager at the time and an A&R guy.
Why didn't they want to see it happen?
Because we were just, we were unsavory, I guess.
Attitude and
we
behavior?
Weren't playing the game the way that everybody else was doing it, and we played by our own set of rules and we just did things our way. And so, granted it was a good band, it was a little risky and scary for most everybody in the industry.
So they thought they'd got beyond that shit.
Well, whatever they were thinking. They just, you know, they'd show up at a rehearsal, you know, thinking because someone said, well, you should sign this band. They're really great. And they'd walk into rehearsal before we were done with the song, just seeing how we worked. They were gone. You know? They had a lot of that kind of stuff going on.
Everyone doing their own thing, drinking their own shit, doing their own drugs.
And loud. just, and you know, whatever. It's hard because I'm so close to it to get a perspective on what other people thought they were seeing. But so when we finally did find a producer to do the record, which is Mike Klink, you know, we went in, we made the record.
Who was it?
Mike Klink.
Yeah.
Was a really great engineer that worked with Ron Nevison for years. So we did the record, and then, you know, we got on to a opening slot with The Cult. Going across Canada and stuff, and it wasn't, you know, it didn't, the record didn't explode in any way, shape, or form, and so then the label wanted to drop it, you know, so it took some effort on a few people's part to keep us signed.
It came out in 87.
It came out in 87,
and I remember, like,
we started hitting 1988,
right? Because, like, I read a piece, like, I remember I had hit the wall on drugs, and I had moved back to Boston, and I was living in an attic in Somerville trying to get sober the first time, and there was, like, an article in Spin, like, you know, basically about, like, this album came out a while ago and no one fucking noticed it properly, like, it's like, this is where this should be, this is the rock record of this decade kind of trip. But it'd been out for almost a year.
It'd been out longer than a year, I think, when it finally, and they'd you know, I think we put out Welcome to the Jungle, and it built up this sort of cult kind of following.
Yeah, because you like were saviors of rock.
I don't know. We definitely wasn't Bon Jovi. You know? So we had this core group of followers and stuff that we weren't totally aware of, because you're on the road.
Yeah.
You don't really know what's going on, and we're just having a good time being on the road and doing our thing. And but then Sweet Child of Mine came out, and it was a big MTV thing, and I hate to say it, but that really exploded. I always hated MTV, but that.
Was that with him in his white leather suit and
Paradise City? That came out afterwards.
Oh, okay.
But so Sweet Child of Mine, and we had that single, and that really blew up. You know,
Paradise City and Rocket Queen are actually my two cuts. Yeah. Those are the ones. I don't even know why. Like, you know, I like Sweet Child. I like the whole record.
For you, the riff in Rocket Queen was actually a riff that we were doing when Duff and Steven and I had a band
called Road
Crew at one point. That's where Rocket Queen first started.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it was like, I didn't realize until I'm looking at it right now. I mean, the life of it was only like, what was it, 5 years of Guns?
Yeah. What, when I...
when you were in the original?
No, no. It started 80, let's say 85 to 96, so 11 years.
Oh, you really did it.
We hung in there. Yeah. So after 96, then there was a point there where everything sort of went south, and so I went off and started doing my own thing, and we didn't get reacquainted for 20 years.
How much was it, like, you know, in terms of looking back on it as, like, just a sober cat, like, how much did drugs shred the band? Ultimately,
I mean,
when did you start getting strung out?
It wasn't the catalyst, though. We managed, and the thing was, is like for me professionally, when we were touring, for the most part, I didn't use, I drank, which was always acceptable,
right?
But when we were off the road for any extended period of time, I'd go down the black hole and I'd have to pull myself out of it and all that. But I think it was more, I mean, obviously. Any kind of chemical influence is going to have some bearing on your logic and how you handle certain situations and all that kind of shit. So I can't say no, it wasn't that.
But you were losing members.
But there was like to death.
You got to go clean up and come back kind of shit.
Well, that was later. There was a situation with Steven that happened, but it was a pretty irretrievable kind of way, you know. And we were trying to get him together, but he just, you know, how
is he still around?
He's still around. So he, you know, so there was the lying and all that, and it just wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
And Steven wasn't the kind of person that under the influence he could just show up and play.
Right.
So there was different people had different, you know, ways.
Couldn't handle the high.
Right, something like that.
Yeah.
So, but I'd say it was more of business management, uh-huh, shit like that, that really was the catalyst, uh-huh, for splitting up, uh-huh, or at least my leaving.
You know? Oh, really?
So the underlying theme was definitely that.
Right, about money.
It wasn't necessarily about, well, yeah, it was about money for those guys.
Yeah.
For us, it wasn't about money, but it was also, you know, playing guys against each other, and I don't know, oh, yeah, where to get into all that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, I'm not such a GNR nerd where I'm going to be like, what about the, you know, so. No,
I didn't expect
that. you know, I have a broad.
It's a complex and ultimately very personal thing.
Sure.
So we just, like, after a while, just like, you know what, it's not worth even trying to explain to, yeah, anybody.
But, and also, like, I mean, it's got to be hard to imagine coming from where you all came from and doing the work and then, you know, becoming this, like, you know, mega million-dollar touring band and recording band. I mean, that's got to change shit. Well,
that was hard too. I mean, you know, the adjustment. Just, I'm not that guy.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
so it was really sort of culture shock.
I can't imagine,
and that was hard. So that really helped, where you just want to sort of bury it all.
Yeah. Like, you know, I want to get back to just me in my room. I want to ride my bike again.
No, just sitting in your house. You don't want to go anywhere. You don't want to hang out in all the places you used to hang out at.
Yeah.
And you just ended up
isolated,
doing smack, and just, you know. Ugh. It was hard, but you know, I learned a lot from it, and I've been through it so many times that now just downtime. And stuff. So now I'm just a complete workaholic.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, congratulations. It's hard to come back from smack.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, really, due to, like, you know,
I know,
a lot of cats.
I'm really, actually, I look back on a lot of shit that I went through, and I'm just really, really, oof, fortunate. Someone up there was looking out for me, because I, you know, I redlined so many times, and I'd come back, and I'd be like,
in the hospital?
Oh, in the hospital, yeah. Sometimes on the floor with paramedics somewhere. I mean, all kinds of shit.
Oh,
and
really?
it didn't freak me out. So I would just keep going.
Right, it was just sort of like, this is part of it.
You know, yeah.
It's like smoking with pneumonia.
Exactly. It's just sort of like, it's not like a focused death wish kind of thing, but you just are not intimidated by any of the pitfalls of the shit that you're doing. You just keep doing it. If something happens to you,
but you didn't want to die.
No, I had no, you know, but you would just do whatever, and whatever happens.
Occasionally you just died sometimes. Yeah. You never came back from being dead and with any sort of wisdom or
no. It never irked me. It's like, well, now that, how long, because they pump you full of naltrexone or whatever it is. It's like, well, how long before I can get high?
Yeah. Oh, you're in, man. Yeah. Seriously committed.
Yeah.
The other records, like the ones you did, like I listened to all the other solo records. I listened to Velvet Revolver, like that. You know, Scott, that's a sad song. Yeah, dude.
Yeah. I was listening to Velvet Revolver night before last, because we're rehearsing right now, and we're going to do a Velvet song, and I hadn't heard it in a while. So I listened.
Guns is?
No, my band.
Oh, your band, yeah.
And so put the song on, and then just let it play, and listen to the rest of the record from there. And I was like, wow. You know, and there was some cool stuff on there, and Scott was brilliant, but God, there was somebody that there was just no coming out. We thought, well, shit, we've been there. We can rally behind him and get him through it. But there was just, it wasn't happening.
No.
But he was great, man.
Yeah.
Such an amazing talent.
Yeah, good singer.
But that was who he was.
Yeah.
So, you know, sort of, you can't really mourn that in the way that you would normal people, because you sort of death.
That's why how he was going to go.
You live on the edge, and
he committed.
Happens, yeah,
it's sad.
He was so good at it though that it surprised me
function.
It shocked me. No, it shocked me when something happened. Yeah.
Oh, well, was it a mistake, an accident, or?
Well, I mean, it's usually an accident. it's called bad chemistry. You know.
Yeah, and now you're lucky you're out before this fentanyl shit. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
Oof, fuck. But no, I'm just saying that you seem to be, you know, with every record, you're still evolving, you're still doing shit you want to do. I mean, this record sounds like,
well, this
fucking
we did
solid hard rock record.
We did this at my I have a little studio here in LA, and it's just raw, and we had this guy Elvis, who is great producing it.
Yeah.
And we, you know, I said I just want to keep it stripped down. We keep trying to do a fucking stripped down record,
yeah,
and then something manages sort of you know, sneak its way in.
Like
there.
What? How does that get away from you, on a production level?
You can get overproduced with drums. You can get overproduced with vocals.
But who's in charge of that? How come no one?
It's just something that you know you go in and we always do it live, yeah. Right? And then you know you start piecing it together from there, and it's just something that can sort of happen without you realizing.
So you lay down, you do a master track, yeah. And then just start cutting into it.
Yeah, I mean, well, no, so you do a master track, and then you put the guitars on, yeah. And everything's cool, and you're doing vocals. But somewhere along the way, there can be some EQ stuff that you put on the drums that really affects the overall sound.
Oh, right.
And you don't really see it coming because you don't hear it on the drums and so much to yourself when you're soloing the drums.
Yeah.
And it's also just from not wanting to have to deal with every little thing every step of the way. You just want to play your guitar and focus on that.
So right.
You know what's going on with
right.
that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I mean, I remember when we were doing Velvet Revolver, you know, we went in there, basically did the record the same way that I've always done records. And we doing this little tiny studio down in Hollywood, right? The place where Hendrix worked. I forgot what it was called. But so everything's going fine. And one day I realized I'd left something at the studio, so I'd gone home. I came back, and I found the engineer just pro-tooling everything together, just moving everything so it's all perfect.
Yeah.
And I was fucking shocked. And I just didn't have the experience to know that that was going to be something that might happen because it's Pro Tools.
Right? Uh-huh. He was tightening up the beauty, the looseness.
Yeah,
he was losing
just moving everything so it falls right on, you know, on the beat, and everything's perfect, and cleaning up any of the sort of nuances and just making it all. And that freaked me out. But that's what the way the record ended up sounding, because there was nothing I could really do about it at that point. I was like, oh, go back and, you know, and then I'm 1/5 of the band too. So it's like,
right.
But so on this one, it was just like, we did it on a fucking 16 track. And although we did it for the first record in a while, we did do it digitally because I just didn't have the resources to do an analog record.
Yeah.
But we didn't sit there and fuck with everything.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's, so that's one thing I always very, attentive to, is to make sure that we don't start getting into tweaking stuff and making it sound too sweet. And the other thing was just having a conversation with Elvis, saying we just got to keep this thing raw and fucking.
Oh man, right out of the gate.
So
right,
I love it for that
first chord. It's like, this is it.
Well, good.
And you got a hit single already, right?
I apparently it's doing pretty well.
Driving Rain.
I don't follow they tell me if there's a. You know, a point that they should tell me, you know, something cool is going on. So, I guess it's the fastest charting single I've had as a solo guy.
Yeah. Rock is back.
Well, I don't know if we're going to. Rock is in a very funny way right now, because this industry is just not.
Yeah.
It's not a rock business anymore.
It's hard to figure out what business it's in.
You know what? I was thinking about
it's the Ed Sheeran business.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's all types of top 40 that they've been putting all types of music into the top 40 filter. So even country music for a minute there sounded like couldn't tell it was. They said it's country band.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You know,
that's right.
And hip hop is huge, and that's all sort of going into this sort of very mainstream. And it'll do what it's going to do until people are tired of it. But rock will always be there. So. And there's always going to be guys that really fucking appreciate what rock and roll is all about and doing it.
You know? I think that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of guitars selling. Everyone's buying guitars.
People love guitars.
Yeah, they do. So, but what about that? Like the blues unit, the blues combo that you put together, like the blues record that you did, or it's not even a record. Did you just tour with the blues?
The blues ball guys?
Yeah.
That was the bass player for that band was the guy I was talking to the other day that I mentioned earlier.
Oh, yeah.
That was just after the sort of Guns N' Roses thing, I just started throwing bands together and jamming and playing on other people's records and just playing all the time. I was pretty out there, just doing all kinds of shit. And I had this one sort of offshoot band with some friends of mine called Slash's Blues Ball.
I remember hearing it somewhere, though.
And it was a really cool band. We just did a lot of covers. There was a couple.
Was there a record?
No. No, we just went around playing any place that would have us.
Did you ever think about just doing a blues record?
It's come up you know, at some point, I'm sure that'll be the thing. That'll be the statement I want to make. But right now, it's just not.
Did you listen to that Rolling Stones one?
That was great.
Dude.
That was a really great record. It's actually in my car.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's so good.
And then, and to really, you know, I mean, the way that they played it, I think you maybe with Stones records, sometimes you forget.
Yeah.
And so when you hear them playing all these old standards, you're like, wow, you know, you really stop and listen to how great they are.
Well, yeah, because like, you know, like that's the one liability of the blues is also the beauty of it, which is that any idiot can play them. So like, you know, the difference between a bar band doing a Jimmy Reed cover and the Stones doing it is that, you know, the Stones are the fucking Stones. That's where they come from. And they're like, when you hear them play it, you're like, now with all this wisdom experience, they're a real fucking blues band.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's so, it just blew my mind, dude. Yeah. And Don was told me, he just.
Don? Yeah, I've
talked to him.
I love Don.
Yeah, sweet. But I talked to him about that record because he said they would just dick around and during rehearsals and play blues numbers and he was recording them and there was no pressure to do a blues record but he said you guys should listen to these that you were just dicking around with, and they knocked that thing out in like three days.
And that's the beauty of it in this day and age where everything is, you know, the way things are put together for them to, as the Stones, who can obviously fly in a record and fly it in from anywhere and to put it together. They did it like the old school way and it sounds amazing. And it's great to hear something. It's really refreshing. In this day and age especially, I mean, that would be a good record at any time, but in this day and age especially, to hear something sound that good that was done in a way that a band, because that's what a rock and roll band is. It's guys interacting with each other and, like I said, that chemistry, this combination of personalities, musicians that come together and make a unique sound unto them.
Yeah.
And people sort of forget that.
So you're going to tour with Miles?
Yeah, I'm going to tour with Miles September into October, then go back out with Guns in November into December.
Are you guys working on a new song?
We'll see what happens. Let's just leave it at that.
Are you in the studio?
No. We just got off the road, and then I went straight in to do this.
And it went good on the road?
That was great. Dude, it was a miraculous couple years.
Yeah.
I was going to say a year and a half, but it's been, as of this November tour, it'll be more than 2 years.
People love it, right?
It's been great, man. It's been, I mean, you know, and I was so, like, you know, there was so much you know, the idea that would ever happen was such a far-fetched thing in my mind.
Right.
And so when we played, I guess it was the first show at the Troubadour, and from that point forward, it was just like, wow. Yeah.
And the people were there for it, right?
Yeah, no, the people were, I mean, I have to say that, you know, with all due respect to the 90s, it was great, but the people coming to the gun shows around the world for this thing has just been unbelievable.
So, and also, you're awake for it.
Yeah. It actually, you know, one of the things, I haven't really figured it out yet, but one of the things that I noticed about it is that I've known, you know, Axl and Duff for 30 some odd years now. And we played these songs. A lot of these songs I played a million times. Some of the new stuff I haven't played until just this tour. But it's weird because it all seems
well Axl's
record. So there is you know, those moments on stage. I'll look over and but it doesn't remind me of anything from the past, which is weird. So I don't have, like, you know, those moments of, like, reminiscing where like in the middle of Welcome to the Jungle and all of a sudden I flash back to another time.
No, it's right now.
It all seems very present.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
oh, that's good.
So that's a trip.
Yeah.
Because,
you know, I wanted to ask you about session stuff, like, because you worked kind of, not extensively, but
I was doing a lot of stuff.
Right, but like a few times with Michael Jackson, right? Like several songs and some live stuff.
Yeah.
What was it like to work with him in retrospect, now that he's gone?
Yeah, Michael's great. I mean, I got that phone call from Guns' tour manager, or no, manager at the time, and said, "Well, Michael Jackson's on the phone." So I was like, "Wow!" You know, and I remember I was at the Riot House, and I was with some chick, and I had the drum, and I was like, "Okay,
the Riot House
like,
is on top of the Roxy. Where is it?
No, the Hyatt. It's not the Hyatt anymore.
Oh, the old Hyatt. Right? Next to the Comedy Store.
Next to Seymour Cassell's house.
Oh, yeah, right, which is behind that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, okay, let me get my shit together. And he goes, well, just meet him down at the record plant at such and such a time. So later that night, I went down there, and it's funny, and I don't mean to name drop, but he was there, and the studio was very dark, and it was him, and it was Brooke Shields, right? So that, for me, you know, I was like Blue Lagoon, and I was like, it's just, what, you know, out of my element.
Was this for which album?
This was Dangerous. Uh-huh. And I guess it was like 92, or 91, or I'm not sure. But anyway, so we met. He was very nice, very cordial, and she wasn't, but no, she was just being herself.
Yeah.
And then so they took off to dinner and just left me with the track.
Yeah.
And just do what you want. And it was cool. It was this song called Give In To Me, and I, you know, put some guitars on it and stuff, and he really dug it. And then he asked me to come down a couple times after that. And then we did a bunch of live performances, like we did an MTV thing. Uh-huh. And then I played with him like in Italy one time and in Germany, and then we did a video.
Well, he just flew you out to
play? Yeah. And it was fun because.
For the whole show or just the songs?
I would just go out for the. Yeah. I mean, I would go for the show, but I mean, I'd go up and play three songs or whatever. But it was great working with him because he is one of the, you know, those great artists that when he would walk on stage and do his thing, and he was a real hard worker, sound check and all that kind of stuff. And it was just...
And dancing.
Yeah, well, that's what I was saying. He'd get up there and start doing the choreography stuff, and one guy, and there's 30 other people doing the same move.
Right.
You could tell Michael was this naturally gifted thing that just flowed through it. So that was pretty amazing to be around. And, you know, all things considered, he just wanted me to be me, and he seemed to really dig that.
And Van Halen played on Beat It, right?
Yeah,
or on one of them?
It was Beat It.
Yeah.
Before,
You friends with Eddie?
Yeah.
How's he doing?
He's good. Okay. He's good. I don't talk to Eddie all the time. I mean, when I say friends, we've hung out a couple times and whatnot, but I did talk to him recently on the phone, and he seemed really good.
That's good. And what was this thing you did with Carole King?
That was a long time ago. Okay, Teddy Zigzag, who was the keyboard player, he actually was on the road with Guns in the 90s, but he was the singer keyboard player for Slash's Blues Ball.
Right.
He was this guy I jammed with all the time, and he worked with Carole, and so they asked me if I would come in, and I think I recorded a song with her, how it happened.
Yeah.
And she was great, because she goes back to that period.
Yeah, Lieber and Stoller.
It's just the whole Laura Canyon thing. So
I was going back to her husband, Goffin. They were like Brill Building.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But she was back in the, she knew the folks?
Yeah, well, I think she knew my mom. So it was cool. It was a very, you know, an honor to go in and work with Carole on something. And then they had me come and play at the Jazz Fest in New Orleans. And
that's a wild venue for you. People must surprise people when they see Slash come out.
I know.
Yeah.
It was fun, though. It was a gas.
And what? Tell me about this. The film production company.
The film production company. All right. Well, I produced a horror movie back in 2013, I guess it was, and it was one of those experiences where it was just fraught with problems. And it was insane.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
But we managed to pull it off, and we finished the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would be something that either turns you on or turns you off.
Right.
Or you can, and it turned me on, and so I'm still doing it. And so I've got all these different things going on in different stages. But I've got a couple deals that just closed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I don't
to make
talk,
movies.
Yeah. So I'm not going to talk about it because I'm not going to jinx it. But it's going. It's a slow process.
Right. But it's like nice to work a different muscle.
It's something that, like, when I was a kid in England, you know, I was turned on to music without, you know, at that time it was like the fucking Who and the Yardbirds and the Kinks and stuff. My dad was into all that shit. And the other thing was horror movies.
Yeah.
I was just naturally just...
Oh, you? That was your thing?
Yeah. So that stuck with me all throughout. And then in the millennium, you know, the horror genre had been dumbed down to its fucking stupidest denominator.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I mean, I would love to be able to get involved with trying to make something that was a little bit more story-driven and character-driven.
Like, what are some of your favorites?
Well, right off the top of my head, with The Omen.
Yeah.
The original Omen was a fucking great horror movie. It was a drama with a little fucked up twist to it.
Yeah.
But it was just intellectual.
The Antichrist.
But it started out, he was just a kid.
Yeah.
Turns out.
It always starts out that way.
But it was a great feature.
Sure.
But I mean, Night of the Living Dead, when I was a kid, I saw that in a drive-in.
Yeah.
with my mom, that and The Exorcist, double bill, oof, right? And yeah. It was just like, God, this is the best.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
There was a lot of great movies that came out through the 70s and then into the 80s. But I think when we got into the Halloween and Friday the 13th uh-huh. franchises,
yeah.
everything started to go in that.
Just murder thrillers.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. yeah.
Just and that's not, you know, like.
Dumb kids going like, what? Going yeah, yeah. there?
Sleepaway
yeah.
camp.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. So you're gonna bring back story driven.
Yeah,
I know. You like those Rob Zombie weirdo movies?
Rob makes movies that really disturb me because he makes movies about psycho rednecks.
Yeah.
But his movies are great. But it's a different thing than what it is.
Well, yeah, it's a kind of a riff on B movies, mm-hmm. and he uses a lot of those real dudes. You know,
yeah.
Like, yeah.
Are you friends with him? And yeah. He's good at what he does, and he does. It's all his thing.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to love that.
Yeah.
And he succeeded at it. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Writing his own flicks and his own style and doing it, you know.
Did you play on that last Alice record?
The last Alice? No.
No.
No. I did.
A lot of people on
No,
there,
I yeah. did play on it. I played on it.
yeah.
I did. But, you know, when I played on it, there was only a couple of us on there. And it morphed into Schools Out with Another Brick in the Wall thrown into it. And then by the time I heard it back, there was like 8 or 9 of us guitar players. Yeah, I don't even know which one's mine.
Right.
One of the cool things about Alice and knowing him for a long time is like if you want to find a rock star model to be like, he's the guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's so cool.
And he's aware that it's a character in a show.
Exactly. He's pretty unaffected. But you know, he had to get his act cleaned up.
Oof,
too,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Which is where the golf thing came in, which to me was always been very anti rock and roll.
Oh, guess what? It's golf. It's conservatism and Christianity. It took a lot.
I accepted it with Alice because I knew where it came from.
Sure,
but I always saw golf as something you should be into because that's when those guys get up early in the morning and work out fucking stealing shit from you on your contracts. Your attorney and your managers and all them. That's when they get together and work out your life.
You play?
No.
You do anything? You physical? You do like working out?
I'm not really sort of like a sports guy.
No, yeah,
I go to the gym and
shape.
Stuff.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, you have to.
Get some cardio going?
Yeah, to keep up with this pace of this.
All right. Well, I love it, man. The new record sounds great. Good luck with the tour. Great talking to
it's
you.
It's been great talking to you.
It's fun, man.
And I have to say, since we're, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you're fucking awesome and glow.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
Dude, I know that guy.
Yeah, we all know that guy.
So I love it. I had no idea. And I have to thank Megan because she goes, you got to watch this with me. It's really good. And I was like, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling.
Right.
I never watched it when it was on TV.
Right.
But she got me into it. And I was like, oh, man, this is great.
I remember this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks, man. It's great meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
All right, that's it. I love that guy. How can you not love that guy? Again, the record, Living the Dream, featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, comes out tomorrow, September 21st. Get it wherever you get that stuff. Do I play some guitar my way? The simple way? The amateur way? After I talked to one of the greatest guitar players that ever lived? No. You know what? I don't. Boomer lives!